It's Fluffit here, back again with another bad bulletin. It's beautiful weather, and I'm hoping you're all having a great weekend. This week, there has only been one truly horrific story that has dominated the news and touched the thoughts and feelings of the public. The needless and unthinkable murder of 5-year-old Rebecca and 11-month-old Daniel Smith, apparently per confession, at the hands of their mother, Leanne Smith, in a hotel room in Lloret de Mar, Spain. This, coupled with the arrest and extradition back to the UK of the child's father, self-proclaimed psychic and one-time most haunted contributor, Martin Smith, only days before, where he was to face 13 counts of sexual abuse, ranging from rape of a child under 16, gross indecency with a girl under the age of 16, indecent assault of a girl under 16, and attempted rape of a girl under 16 at Carlisle Magistrates Court. The subject matter combines two of the most controversial and taboo things that can ever be discussed or debated by the public, child murder and paedophilia. And although in a different setting and medium perhaps, I'd like to explore these topics further, I feel it's more fitting in what is a sceptical cast to look at how people perceive and consider the facts when faced with such emotive issues. How we can be manipulated and thrown by the way a person presents themselves, and how a more sceptical approach to life can afford us the ability of better awareness and vigilance of what's around us. As such, it's impossible for anyone in reading the series of events that resulted in two innocent children's lives being taken by their own mother to not have an extreme depth of emotion and opinion invested in what they are being presented with, and any sceptical comment or consideration of the facts presented from the public on such an emotive issue will always be marred by the sheer inability to comprehend how such events and actions could ever be carried out by another human being in the first place. When faced with such abhorrent acts, the public often find it difficult to discuss or debate them rationally, because they simply instill such anger, frustration and horror and invoke the deepest set of emotions we all have. Before I go on, I'd like to make it clear that the facts of this case are still emerging, and although it's vital that people should talk and debate and think about the facts of the case and the facts alone, there is an ever-present awareness that in doing so, people tend to feel uncomfortable and often, as a result, jump to the knee-jerk emotional responses that we all do when faced with such horror, overlooking confirmed fact for a take that better sits with their feelings, beliefs, or wish to fit in with what they perceive as the default opinion. We, I believe, have on us all, as a society, a responsibility to look at how we perceive and consider others and such events, how we react to them, but more importantly, what we learn from them and what we can do or change to prevent them or avoid them in ourselves. Whilst the emotional side of our responses is valid and the horror we feel justified, the rational side of our responses is what will educate us to better recognise and deal with such things and people in the future as a society and as individuals. Perhaps if just one person had been alerted to even the smallest of hints of what may have occurred or considered evidence and facts around the Smiths and the events prior to the consequences for those two children could have been far different, and indeed for the victims of the abuse it's alleged Martin Smith, their father, has carried out. What should never be lost sight of, or forgotten specifically in the media onslaught or the public's minds, is the two children that were murdered are the victims of the sexual abuse, and indeed the ways in which everyone can and should become more aware and vigilant. In reading literally scores of articles in the story, ranging from the sensationalist and assumptive offerings from much of the Red Top press to the more fact-based and considered reporting from the more reputable sources, one thing struck me as a constant. In commenting on the articles dealing with the story on newspapers, websites and forums, they had just read many people had ignored facts presented only inches above them in articles they had just read and in some cases even chose to offer their own assumptions as fact, clearly convinced that they had read something far different than what they actually had. When faced with any correction to their comments, the retort was to instead return to a focus on the tragedy and the emotional distress the story invokes, which, although understandable, merely reinforced a completely incorrect bit of information and implied that facts weren't as important as raw emotion in considering what had happened. For example, on one website, a commenter had decided that it was likely the children's deaths had been the result of some unavoidable accident involving carbon monoxide poisoning. Despite confirmation in the article they had just read that stated a full confession had been offered by the mother and confirmed by the police as having been taken. Also, many had stated on various sites that the mother was clearly out of her mind and as such could not be held responsible for her actions despite confirmed reports that she had undergone psychological testing which had concluded she was very much aware of what she had done and as such had been considered fully capable of being held responsible for her actions by the Spanish magistrate. It's almost as if when faced with the evidence likelihood of something so unfathomable and unbelievable as a mother killing her own children, we are, as humans, simply instead looking for less abhorrent and acceptable reasons for what has happened, with any rational thought once again coloured by an emotional investment and social prior perceptions and rules. The same thing is exactly why we often are unable to see the potential in a person for doing something we find morally disgusting and wrong, and it's what these very people use against us to manipulate and deceive us into trusting them or discounting them as a threat. And that's why I feel it's so important, if we are to prevent or expose people who prey on the vulnerable or abuse and con people as a way of life, we all need to start to employ more scepticism in everything we do, more dealing in fact and evidence and more awareness of the effects of perception and influence on our ability to consider and judge a situation or a person. As far as the media is concerned, we tend to as a nation to take what we're told is read as fact. The reality is, if you read 10 different articles in the same story, you will find 10 slightly different reports on those facts. We all too often take statements to begin with, a source said, it's believed that, and the worst of all, it's thought that, as factual. When in reality, they're simply the unconfirmed musings of some hack who just wants to grab your attention. We also as a nation tend to grab our news from the first source we can find, or the one we usually watch or read, and rely on that to shape and inform our views on subjects so important and vital to our lives, with little further research or comparison. In reading over 30 articles in this particular case, while researching this bulletin, in one day, all written that day, and with the same facts available to the writers, I came across 16 inconsistencies between the reports given, ranging from out-and-out guesswork to completely incorrect information. It's time we as a society reclaimed our own thoughts and started to look behind what we read or care about to really inform ourselves and perhaps instigate and educate others and ourselves in the process, because I have a feeling if we did and we encouraged our children to do so in the same vein, there would be far less apathy and a lot more outrage and wish to get involved in changing what we are all too often too ill-informed to comment on or act on with any real effectiveness. Returning to the theme of how we can be manipulated and how our perceptions can be used against us by others, it's not entirely lost on me that Martin Smith, the man accused of the 13 counts of abuse at the centre of the events that have unfolded and the very person whom our attention should be focused on when looking at the source of the consequences, claimed to be a psychic medium. Now, far from mentioning this as some utterly nuts implication that somehow this makes it more likely he's guilty of the crimes of abuse, or that in any way claiming to be a psychic is somehow an indication of a tendency towards paedophilia, which of course is a completely incorrect assumption, my intention in looking at this fact is to highlight how, if the allegations are proved true, that someone responsible for such heinous crimes and abuse could and did go unnoticed by those he worked with, those he read for, and those he mixed with on a daily basis, all unsuspecting of his far darker and odious actions and intentions. Rather than a psychic being somehow more likely to commit sexual abuse, which is ridiculous as an assumption, and is most definitely not what I'm saying, let's make that clear, what I am saying is that a paedophile using that as a front and the abilities involved to influence is a strong and powerful tool when used to groom or disguise his actions or intent. And it creates an air of imagined trust and an unthreatening character, which is all too often the vital considerations that a child abuser requires. When faced with a psychic's cooing love and light, gaining the trust of clients and forging this reputation of being utterly unthreatening, if slightly kooky, as a persona, the defences of most people are instantly down. Who, when in the presence of someone who professes to know and see all, who by association is considered to hold great belief in an afterlife where all actions are seen and judged, and who claims to be able to see your innermost thoughts and fears, would first thought would be, this man is capable of a crime so abhorrent in the eyes of all? Well, you wouldn't. However, the more sceptical amongst us may instantly consider anyone who can lie on a daily basis, manipulate people into believing them, and influence the perception of clients so apparently easily may very well be someone to keep an eye on. But sadly, most people don't apply that same thought process, and this would allow anyone with a darker motive or intent the perfect cover and opportunity to abuse that trust in any way they saw fit for any aim they wished. When Most Haunted employed Smith as a guest medium on a show that aired a month before he fled the country, it's highly unlikely they would have looked at him or talked to him and had even an inkling for a second that he may be capable of the crimes he's accused of. But what should have been apparent is that if they'd used any sceptical thought at all in anything they do, was that he was not able to do what he claimed as a psychic. And they weren't alone in that, because he was a regular in the psychic circuit and offered his services to many clients daily throughout the 10-year period when the crimes he's accused of were taking place. None of whom so far have come forward to say they had the slightest suspicion that he was fake or that he may have committed the crimes he's now standing trial for. But, and I know it's an after-the-fact but of a massive proportions, what if they all had applied a more sceptical thought process to his claims of psychic ability throughout that time? What if they had instead, or simply thought about simply accepting what he was saying, they had taken a little more and a deeper look and questioned the validity of evidence for his claims, and indeed into his character and his life? Is it impossible that by doing so they may not only have arrived at the conclusion he was a fake and conning them with his claims of psychic ability, but also then those around him or subscribing regularly to his readings may have then further applied that knowledge of his manipulative and deceitful nature, and realised other things he may have said and done outside of that setting didn't add up? Could his constant claims of seeing and hearing and experiencing things that blatantly weren't real have alerted people to his mental state, or indicated a man who clearly was living in a world of his own invention faster if they had only put aside their willingness to believe what they wanted to hear and see, and applied a more rational, less emotional-led perception of what he was doing and who he was? My point is that if we as a nation applied more sceptical approach to how we perceive people and what we choose to consider fact rather than fiction, we would perhaps have a far better ability to expose and become aware of people who are committing far worse crimes than taking us for a few quid and desecrating the memories of our loved ones, as serious as that is. It's not just about applying it to psychics, it's about applying it to everything and everyone in our lives who has the ability to influence or affect our choices or colour our decisions, and most importantly, who can, if allowed, cause us and others great harm if gone unquestioned. Bad people don't wear a flashing neon sign saying, avoid me at all costs. They come in all shapes, sizes and genres and can appear as anything they wish to perpetuate. Bad people don't, contrary to what the sun may have you believe, skulk around in the cover of darkness, all bearded and beady eyes, shiftily throwing out heavy hints they aren't to be trusted. Con merchants, murderers, paedophiles, whatever deviant you wish to name, are present in every walk of life, in every town and city the world over, and in every profession you could care to think of. They aren't always the town recluse, the flashy, smug, silver-tongued rogue, the loner who kept themselves to themselves next door, the social outcast that looks like a real wrong one as they shuffle about in dirty clothes stinking of booze. These are stereotypes and dangerous ones that feed our inability to be wary or question anyone who doesn't fit that narrow margin. They can be the apparently nice person you work beside, the fully high-level functioning member of society, the quiet, hard-working family man who always smiles when you pass him on the way to the shops, the respected businessman or woman, or perhaps most horrifically and unthinkable, the man or woman we love, or the family member we've known all our lives. In the case of sexual abuse, and in particular child abuse, the majority of offenders are either known to the victim as a family friend, hold some level of trust or respect in the community, or sadly, are members of the victim's family. Much in the way a repeat business psychic will try to use their knowledge of a sitter to provide them with information to influence them that they are genuine or trustworthy, to manipulate them and gain some level of investment from the sitter, and to shape and groom them into coming back for more, they will tell them what they want to hear. They will offer them the false gift of talking to a dead loved one they thought was gone forever, and they will convince them that they have more issues or problems than they came in the door with in a bid to get their repeat business and money. These self-same techniques and attributes are present and used by most all and any sexual predator or con man to groom and pull in their prospective victims. They will tell them they know things about them or their families to instill an idea they are interested or known to the family. They will say things that are flattering or sympathetic to the prospective victim in a bid to make them feel they care and boost a sense of misplaced security. They will offer tidbits of information or give them gifts to influence their perception or their intent. They will then most horrifically withdraw all of that and replace it with threats of terrible consequences and bullying should they not do what they have asked. So the person targeted is so manipulated, so stripped of any and all sense of self and confidence, and so afraid to even attempt to explain or tell anyone outside of that concerted and relentlessly targeted relationship forged by the abuser, that they all too often are left entirely alone to face what no one should ever have to face or be subjected to. If we are to educate ourselves and others in better ways to recognise this kind of behaviour, in ways of exposing it at the first evidence of it being present, avoiding being taken in or blinded to it by those who do it, and in preventing the horrific and shattering chain of events that can be triggered as a consequence, then we need to stop allowing this blinding acceptance in our life, in all areas of our life, and begin to be far more sceptical in our approach to things in general, and to encourage it in our children also. It's not about instilling fear. And it's not about terrifying ourselves with the thought that anyone we know might be able to cause us harm or rip us off. And it's definitely not about living a cynical, jaded life that requires us to instantly expect danger or deceit in all we see, hear and know. It's about simply taking a step back and applying what we do know as fact, combined with the evidence we are faced with, before accepting a claim, a person or a situation as genuine. It's about remembering how powerful a sway our emotions can be when looking at the facts, and how easily we can and are influenced by others when making the most important decisions we'll ever make in our lives. Well, as mentioned earlier, Most Haunted hasn't exactly been enjoying the best press recently. However, it's back. Most Haunted's new trailer says, "If the darkness could speak, what would it say?" Well, I'm tempted to guess nothing, since much like the spirits the Beatty Bunch profess to chase, it doesn't have a voice box, being just an absence of light and all that. But if it did, it would probably echo the sentiments of anyone left still watching the show and saying, "This has gone beyond mildly entertaining in a so bad it's funny way to just plain old repetitive boring nonsense." The new series began this week in Living TV, despite reports earlier this year that Five had wooed the show and fielding away. It would seem they still have to see out any existing contract by showing this last series, which was already filmed and in the can before the start of the disastrous last live from Prague. Or, perhaps as official confirmation of the move to Five still doesn't seem to be forthcoming, it may have fallen through. Who knows, and really, who cares, but one thing's for sure, This already out-of-date new series is bound to see a further decline in viewers who won't tune in to watch a series that is already out-of-date, with a medium who's already left, with more of the same old rehashed repetitive dross, leaving Five, if they are still in a deal, wondering if they wouldn't be buying a paranormal pig in a poke. It's telling that far from the usual two-week build-up and fanfare with endless trailers showing practically in every ad break for Living when a new series comes out, this one introduced itself with the unannounced, embarrassed shuffle onto the screen of a guest fully aware it wasn't invited to the party, gingerly going about the motions in the hope no one really noticed it. I'd imagine also that the Beatty Bunch aren't best pleased at having to air a show that includes a medium who had already left, somewhat vocally, in Chris Conway. Further indication of the show's decline, and perhaps also of Living's growing disinterest, is the impending closure next month of the official Living Most Haunted forum, along with other Virgin Media forums due to lack of interest and use. Well, that's the official line. But in the case of the Most Haunted forum, it may just have as much to do with the fact that it became a place where the majority of the very few users left vocally aired their criticism of the show, and bar the odd stalwart believers' occasional warblings, the general feeling was that Most Haunted was dead in the water as far as ever being taken seriously or redeeming itself with the viewers or fans concerned. I won't mention or bother to review the highlights of the first episode as well. There weren't really any. Nothing worth mentioning, to be honest. There was nothing of interest or new that couldn't be found in every single prior episode anyone's ever seen, or indeed any of the multitude of other ghost-chasing vehicles out there at the moment. That's why, if A Move to Five is still pulled off, even a miraculous reinvention and reworking of the show still won't bring the viewers back in the numbers it once enjoyed. You just can't alienate fans and bore viewers for as long as they have without it eventually coming back to bite you right where it hurts. To a much fluffier tale. Now, I love our furry feline friends as much as the next scratched and regularly ignored cat sitter. Okay, I'm allergic and they make me itch. But for the one fortnight a year I look after a friend's, even I can see just how attached and close people become to their pet puss. So when one goes missing, it's not surprising that they are affected by the loss, in much the same way they would be if they lost anything they loved. Sue Machin of Boothby Griffaut in Lincolnshire is one such cat lover who is searching for her missing feline, Oliver, who went AWOL from her home last October, and after having no luck in finding him using more conventional methods, she's enlisted the services of one of the many pet finder services springing up out there who, for a price, attempt to track down the whereabouts of your lost animal. Animal Search UK, the company Sue approached, however, seemed to think that enlisting the services of a psychic in Bangalore is going to help them find a cat in Boothby, which by any stretch of the imagination is highly unlikely to be a good use of the £1,000 Sue paid them to bring her cat back. Yep, you heard right. Sue parted with a grand, which is a lot of cash to ask of anyone these days, and it's not clear how much of that was then used by Animal Search UK to hire psychic Savita Gupta. But one thing's for sure, they certainly could have put it to better use than calling some psychic punter in Bangalore, who for a tidy sum will spout the usual generic rubbish about the whereabouts of the cat that pretty much anyone could offer Sue for free. Sue says, "The expense for the search is immaterial. I'm just desperate to know what has happened to him. I'm hoping he's wandered off and been picked up by someone." And as usual, it's that desperation and need that is the friend of anyone who wants you to part with your cash for pretty much any service. Tom Watkins of Animal Search UK says, "We've had some good publicity, and we're building up a picture of where Oliver might be. We're hoping the psychic is right, and we will receive a call about where Oliver is." Well, Tom, the publicity may indeed have given the search some attention in the public, but let's remember, it's that alone, coupled with the 3-day search and doorstepping 400 local homes planned, that may prompt someone to call in with info or find the cat, not the involvement of a psychic. Some psychic stating the obvious that someone somewhere may have the cat or have seen it isn't really helping you at all in any other way, is it? And don't get me wrong, I've heard some good success stories in the press about pet search companies who, for a smaller fee, apply one simply dedication and detective work in finding lost pets for their owner. They put out the word around animal rescue and shelters, coordinate searches and flyers, follow up sightings and leads for you. But most of all, they make it very clear that the likelihood is they may not be successful. And they prepare you for the possibility that you may have lost them for good despite all your efforts. What they don't do is throw some far-flung mystic into the search, then allow their random warbling to influence the search or give the owner some misplaced false hope that there are higher powers than detective work on the case. To be fair, Animal Search UK are embarking on a full-on search of the local area and have four detectives coordinating a more conventional door-to-door operation for their fee. But it's their choice to involve a psychic at all that for me does their reputation harm and indicates a willingness to promote this kind of rubbish as a means to an end for desperate pet owners out there. In fact, they're doing themselves out of business by giving the idea that a psychic may be able to assist. And it says to a prospective client, why use the company at all if the owner can go straight to the psychic instead, which, of course, in reality, would be utterly pointless. So far, Psychic Gupta has said she believes the missing cat has been adopted by a stray, or as a stray by a new family, who might not know that she already has an owner. Whatever their cut of the 1,000, by any standards, that little revelation is not worth even a pound. There only are really three possibilities. It's in a new home, it's wandering wild, or regrettably and hopefully not the correct choice, it's dead. Unless Gupta can tell you an exact location or the name of the people who have it, what's the point in paying them anything? And if the cat is found, of course Gupta will claim she predicted it, rather than it being the result of all the hard work those really searching will have put in. Either way, of course, Sue won't care if the end result is the return of her cat. She says, Oliver may have wandered onto the road and somebody may have picked him up. I feel he must be somewhere. I can't accept something has happened to him. And there, in a sentence, is exactly what all psychics rely on, whether it's a search for a cat or something of a far more destroying and tragic loss, such as that of a missing child. The not knowing, the desperation to find the answer, and the hope that acceptance of a loss is something you never have to face in finality. When a psychic's efforts are applied to a search for a cat, it seems just a bit of farcical nonsense, a fluffy human interest story to end a local news bulletin with of a Friday night. But apply it to the hundreds of psychics who involve themselves in the search for missing children, and suddenly it becomes a far greater worry to think there are people being convinced a psychic's involvement is somehow desirable or in any way useful. Not such a quirky little inconsequential tale anymore, when you realise that this is exactly what thousands of psychics do, only in a circumstance and case that involve a hell of a lot more at risk than just a missing moggy. Well, this has been Fluffhead once again reporting for the Bad Bulletin. Hope you enjoyed.
Check out the website at www.badcast.co.uk.